Here are the three things that we need to talk about today. The Epstein affair is about to be out in the open. Republicans have failed to protect the president and other very powerful people from keeping the files private. We now have more details on the talks between the Russians and the Americans to end the Ukraine war with or without Zelensky's consent and with or without the EU's consent. How about that? And one of the reported details of this plan is to have the Russians keep what they've already taken or liberated. What about Crimea? I'll tell you about that. There's news there, too. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. And hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Happy Thursday. I got to tell you something. I didn't think this could happen, but damn, it's happened. And here's the headline. The House and the Senate have passed a law forcing the Justice Department of the United States of America to release the Jeffrey Epstein files. And that can and likely will be something that opened Pandora's box of secrets that might have some very powerful people all over the world shaking in their proverbial boots because now people are going to find out what they may have done with Epstein. And you know what's truly bizarre about this bill? It was forced through because some boisterous Republicans got together with some stubborn Democrats to make it happen. Look, it's a rare day in America when Republicans agree with Democrats on anything. But here they are. Here's Democrat Ro Khanna, Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican Thomas Massie, who pushed this measure through.
The truth is finally going to come out. And when it comes out, this country is really going to have a moral reckoning.
The founders set up our government with three branches and two branches of Congress. And I don't think it's any coincidence that this fight is being started and it's being won in the House of Representatives. I have people, other survivors of other sex crimes, who come to me and say, thank you. You give me hope. You give us hope. There is hope here.
This only became possible today because the American people whom we serve as representatives here in Congress demanded that this vote happen, and they put more pressure on every single elected politician in this city than has ever been put on them.
You know what's funny about this? Even in death, Epstein's influence seems so far impenetrable. These are the givens that you already know about him, right? He enticed many of the most powerful people in the world into his abusive and illegal scheme. His ties to Israel, come on, undeniable. So are his ties to the president of the United States. And there's one other thing. Even as he was about to be arrested and placed in a cell where he would later die, he still, in that very moment, was able to influence Congress. This is crazy. I'm going to show you some remarkable video. It's prepared, props to the Washington Post, where Epstein is texting a U.S. representative and telling her what to do as she questioned Donald Trump's fixer, Michael Cohen. You got to see this. So here's what we did. On the bottom of the screen, you're going to see Epstein's texts as he's sending her texts in real time, as he's watching her in Congress, because this is televised. It begins, by the way, it begins with him scolding her for chewing gum while in Congress. Here, watch, here it is.
And while we were once driving through a struggling neighborhood in Chicago, he commented that only black people could live that way.
Attorney-client privilege, yes, I will turn it over.
You, as my friend Mr. Meadows pointed out, misled this committee even today in a written submission that contradicted your testimony. You have suggested you are going to review that. Are you going to review it in our next break to correct the record, yes or no?
Yes.
Question, you helped out the president's campaign or were involved in the campaign as a representative, as a spokesman. Even in your words today, it was your idea for the campaign dating back to 2011. Is that accurate, yes or no?
Yes.
Mr. Weisenberg and other individuals, Ms. Rona. Who are those individuals? Are they with the Trump Organization?
They are.
Are there other people that we should be meeting with?
So, Alan Weisselberg is the chief financial officer.
You got to quickly give us as many names as you can so we can get to them.
Yes, ma'am.
As Ms. Rona, what is Ms. Rona's position?
Rona Graff is the Mr. Trump's executive assistant.
And would she be able to corroborate many of the statements that you've made here?
Yes, she was. Her office is directly next to his, and she's involved in a lot that went on.
Good work. Did you see that? Good work. He's coaching her, telling her what to say and what to do. How amazing is that? Epstein sitting in front of his TV directing a U.S. representative while Congress is in session. I mean, how powerful was this guy? And is this the real story here that we still eventually need to find out when all the files and are finally released and the real story unfolds? Yeah, look, sure. Lurid details about sexcapades involving politicians, including possibly the president of the United States, will no doubt fuel the headlines for quite some time. But even more important is the power that this guy wielded, what he was able to do to change things with that power. Let me tell you what I've learned about Epstein. He was able to influence the courts. He was able to influence Congress. He was able to influence the Senate. But he didn't do it the normal way. You see, the normal way is just to bribe those people or blackmail those people, right? No. He did it by bribing the people who bribed them. Yeah. He owned the donors, right? The people who really run America, most would argue. In other words, he didn't work the puppets. He worked the puppet masters. And that is, in the end, why this vote by both members of Congress and members of the Senate is so surprising. What those unseen files may reveal are the names of the people who feed those members of Congress and those members of the Senate the money that keep them in office. And that's why the political implications could be far-reaching, maybe even game-changing. Stay tuned. We're learning more today, learning more about these negotiations that have been taking place between the Russians and the Americans. This is important stuff, conversations that have been occurring without the knowledge of most of us and the media. I didn't know. Without the knowledge of Europe's elites and the EU, without the knowledge of NATO, and most importantly, without the knowledge of Vladimir Zelensky, nor members of his government. Think about that last one for just a minute. That means Zelensky is being snubbed by the White House while he's losing the war with his soldiers deserting in droves and is at the same time embroiled in a scandalous corruption scandal, right? Strike one, strike two, strike three. Are you out of there? That's why both the military and the geopolitical analysts are describing Zelensky's condition right now as near fatal.
One has to wonder, is this that suddenly within Ukraine on its own, their counter embezzlement functions and their anti-corruption groups or whatever just suddenly found up all the stuff and it's bubbling up? Or, and I think this is the more plausible anyway, that the United States and or the West, or some combination of the two, have been telling Zelensky, you're going to have a negotiated settlement. You're going to get this, what we always call the ugly deal. You're going to take the ugly deal, or we're going to take some other action. And if Zelensky was balking on that, if he was not being willing to do it, then I think they said, and by the way, we know about all this corruption. And believe me, we know about this corruption. We can bring this back on you. We're going to expose your right-hand men. And if you still don't make any action, then we're going to expose you.
Can you imagine if that conversation's taking place or has taken place already with Zelensky? By the way, some of Russia's headliner politicians, they're not holding back. This is a scathing and very public rebuke I'm about to share with you. It's Dmitry Medvedev. He is who's known for these kinds of things, by the way, I should tell you. But he's calling Zelensky, quote, Kiev's killer clown. And he suggested that the walls, like Danny Davis just said, are closing in on him.
A few days ago, I said that the killer Kiev clown, or KKK, could still jump up and down on the support line of the West, but the pustule in Europe would have to be burst anyway. Looks like the festering is progressing more quickly than could be expected. It's not just an abscess bursting open. We're talking about the Banderite regime developing gas gangrene, which means it will have to self-amputate and remove the rotting part of its body. Otherwise, the ugly KKK creature as a whole will face imminent death. Oh well, good riddance. And the success of our armed forces is the best catalyst for its painful and inevitable demise.
Sounds almost Pushkin-esque, huh? That's some writing. Here's what we know so far. U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff and Russian envoy Kirill Dmitriev have been engaged in conversations, and apparently they're working their way through 28 points to bring about the end of the war in Ukraine and better relations between the two nuclear superpowers, the United States and Russia. What about the specifics, right? All right, first, neither Washington nor Moscow is going to give any official comments on the specifics of this plan so far, but there is some reporting on what those specific points are. Here, let me take you through some of them. Ready? Number one, and again, let me underscore that neither the White House nor the Kremlin have confirmed any of these, but here we go. It's being reported that the draft would require Ukraine to make very large concessions by having to recognize or at least tolerate Russian control over occupied territories, and those territories could or would include the Donbas as well as Crimea officially. Here's number two. Ukraine would have to significantly reduce its armed forces, essentially relinquishing longer range and offensive categories of weaponry. Makes sense. Number three, Ukraine would agree to barring certain international military units from operating on Ukrainian soil. In other words, you know what? Can't have the Brits and the Parisians and the Germans soldiers in Ukraine pointing their missiles at Moscow. No way. That's what started this thing in the first place, many Russians in the government would argue. There's also some reporting, by the way, that Mr. Trump has already signed off on the proposal brought back to him by Witkoff, which is interesting. As for the Russians, they're saying, on the record anyway, that there are no new developments to report. They remain tight-lipped. Can you blame them? After the fiasco, the thumping, the media sabotage both they and the Trump White House received after trying to negotiate out in the open the last time, you remember? The Alaska summit was a disaster. That's why this time they're keeping the talks private. Okay, after a short break, we are going to discuss some of these peace plan deals, some of these details and all the machinations that involve them, as well as everything going on with Epstein. Boy, what a story that's turning out to be and will continue to be with Radhika Desai. She's a professor at the University of Manitoba and the director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group. She's also my friend, and I can't wait to talk to her. She's coming up next. Let me tell you about Radhika Desai, my next guest. She's the professor at the University of Manitoba. She's the director of Geopolitical Economy Research Group. And she happens to be one of the smartest people I know. And I happen to have spent a good long while with her. We had a few lunches, a few dinners, maybe even a few adult beverages while we were together there in Valdai. And it was really a wonderful experience for me because she has a real understanding of how the world works in many ways. And she's good enough to join us now to talk about some of the things that are taking place in the world. I guess, well, first of all, good to see you, my friend.
Great to see you, even if you're being too kind.
No, you, right? As they say in the movies. I think that was De Niro, by the way. So let's start with what I started with. What do you make of this development in the United States? I kind of thought that they would be able to bury the Epstein thing, because the people who want it buried are much more powerful than the rest of us. But somehow, enough people in both parties, I mean, you got to give, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene credit. She really pulled this thing off. A lot of people thought she was a bit of a Looney Tune, but I mean, she's fought hard, and I think she's been on the ethical side of this thing. And between her and Massey and Khanna, I think they did a hell of a job bringing this thing out. What are your thoughts?
You know, the way you put it actually just made me think of something very fundamental. The election of Trump himself is a sign that the American ruling class, the most powerful people in the United States, were losing their hold on power. That is, because if their hold on power was intact, you wouldn't have had an outsider like Trump come in and essentially win an election. Now, so that's the first thing. Second thing is that, of course, Trump could only win the election by making all sorts of promises to ordinary people, you know, that he was going to make America great again, and he was going to release the Epstein files. So he had campaigned on this. And I guess what you're looking at is a situation in which the MAGA people, anyway, who have been campaigning for this, they are basically saying to Trump, look, if you don't do this now, you are going to face electoral disaster. And remember also that this has occurred in the aftermath of the series of election defeats that the Republicans suffered just recently, just last month. And I think that is very significant. I think that, you know, Trump can go around saying inflation is down and grocery bills are down when in fact they're going up because, you know, he can say whatever he likes and he does say whatever he likes. But when the polls show, when the real voting shows, not just the opinion polls, but when the real voting shows that things are going wrong, then Trump has to sit and Trump has to sit and listen because his whole claim to the presidency relies on the fact that unlike the Bidens or the Obamas or the Clintons or the Harrises, I can win elections. And so that's what he's doing. And I think in the larger scheme of things, we're also looking at a situation in which more and more people are asking, have you already seen peak Trump? That is to say, Trump has peaked, and from now on, things can go downwards. Because ever since his inauguration, ever since his election, he has subjected the United States with, you know, a barrage, you know, a never-ending barrage of announcements, surprises, executive orders, actions, and their reversals. And I mean, he's kept the whole world entertained. But I think now the contradictions are going to mature and then the proverbial shit is going to hit the fan because he's facing reversals, not just on Epstein. He's had, you know, the electoral losses. He's had the Supreme Court is going to rule on tariffs. China has faced him down, all sorts of legal challenges to his executive orders. The British are no longer cooperating with him on Venezuela. I mean, you know, things are beginning to go
unravel. Against. Yeah. You know, I'd love to get your opinion on this. I was thinking about this, like you, I hear something and then it makes my mind go 50 miles an hour. And I think through it and I go, wait a minute. You know what I think Trump's problem here is? It's not just Epstein alone. It's the fact that there are two guilty parties that everyone is tying to Epstein, right? One of them is powerful people, including the President of the United States, and the other one is Israel. Israel. So Trump is in a box with Israel, so he's kind of getting a double whammy from the American people because nobody in America right now likes Israel. They're very anti-Zionist right now, especially in his party. The Republican Party is worse than the Democrats when it comes to this issue. So he's tied into this bow with a knot around Israel and Epstein together. And I think that really is, I would bet that's damaging him. What do you think?
And you know, in a certain sense, the fact that Tucker Carlson interviewed this guy, Fuentes, is a symptom of the fact that MAGA is interested in this sort of stuff.
And, well, I can understand why they're interested in this kind of stuff. I mean, to be fair, as a journalist, everything that I've looked into, everything that I've researched, every source that I have spoken to has proved to me that Epstein was heavily, heavily associated with Israeli intel and may very well have been working at their behest to blackmail people, to get information, and to influence powers, not just only in the United States, but also in Canada and in Great Britain and in several other countries. That's a hell of a thing.
Absolutely.
So at this point, what do you think Trump has to do to be able to, or can do, to rid himself of this Epstein malaise that he seems to be going through?
Well, I think that, you know, we are going to see some really interesting outcomes now, or really interesting developments, shall we say, because as you say, that Trump's plan is unraveling, and his plan was always based on all sorts of illusions. By the way, remember also that another reversal he's faced is that he's... he didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize,
yeah.
And he's still angling for the same. But anyway, Trump's plan was that, you know, he will, you know, his whatever he does will somehow work out. Not that he had any coherent plan around it. But of course, precisely given that his plan was so flimsy, and it had to be flimsy because any serious plan to address the problems of the United States would have involved tackling the very power structure to which Trump himself is very devoted. In that, he's no different from Biden or Harris or what have you. So since he's not going to do that, he has made all sorts of shows. I'm going to impose tariffs. I'm going to make peace. I'm going to deport immigrants. And all of this is coming back at him. So now Trump has a choice. He can either double down or he can reverse course. Of course, anything straightforward is practically impossible for Trump. So I think what you're going to witness is a situation in which Trump, who, as you know, he says that, you know, grocery bills are down when they are manifestly not.
Yeah.
He will continue this effort to try to claim that things are going his way, no matter how great the counter evidence, and eventually this will only lead him to irrelevance. You know, I mean, I don't think he's going to give up his attempt to try and make, because he has got no other act. That is the only thing that's Trump's signature style,
yeah,
right? Is to say,
yeah,
everything is going well and so on. So I think that I think he will continue doing that, but American voters are not dumb. They have been watching. They have been looking at what's going on. They can look at their pocketbooks. They can look at what's going on their TV screens. And I think that they have already delivered Trump a message, and they'll probably deliver another, a rather sad one, come next November.
This is something you and I talked about when we were together in Valdai, but do you at least give him credit for partially bucking the neoconservative game plan? Obviously, he has not done that with Israel. I give you that. And if he is going to do what he says he's going to do in Venezuela, that is definitely coming from the first chapter of the neocon playbook. But in other areas, I've seen that he's actually bucked them somewhat. Seems to be bucking them now. I think he just got rid of Kellogg, who was the guy who was going to be handling Ukraine, who was like another Biden. And it seems to me that if he's able to pull this Ukraine thing off and end this thing on reasonable terms, then I would have to give him props for that, right?
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, look, I don't think Trump is interested either in the neocon plan or any plan. Trump is interested in looking as though whatever he did worked. That's the first thing. So in that sense, I think that if he has pulled back on certain, you know, he has moderated his position, fine. I mean, that is exactly what Trump does. Remember the expression taco, Trump always chickens out. I mean, he tried to apply tariffs, but then when all sorts of affected constituencies revolted, whether they were the countries concerned or the American business people or whatever, then he cut the tariffs back. So you've had this strange tariff show on again, off again. So Trump is constantly doing reversals. As I said, that is his style. But the point is that he wants to make it look as though it's not a reversal, that he's doing fine. So that's the first thing. Secondly, you mentioned this peace plan that is allegedly in the works, the Ukraine peace plan. And I suspect that unless You know, the Russians have basically said that nothing has changed in their position since Alaska, since forever, quite frankly, since the beginning of the special military operation, for that matter. So they're saying nothing has changed. So then how is he going to pull it off unless he concedes everything to the Russians, which until recently he was not willing to do? Remember, just a few weeks ago, he was imposing threatening India and China and Brazil for buying Russian oil, and he was going to impose secondary tariffs and what have you. These are so he at that point he was annoyed with President Putin for not, you know, coming to some sort of negotiated settlement. But the fact is, Putin's position has not changed. So it will now, if he achieves this peace deal, it will be essentially agreeing with the Russian position, which will of course put the Europeans' noses out of joint. And of course, Zelensky, well, you already mentioned that what a pickle he's in, or what a series of pickles he's in. So, I mean, his political life is now probably in its last days, but we'll have to see about that.
That's why I think Trump might be able in this. Well, let me rephrase that. I think if there's ever been an opportunity for Trump to be able to pull something like this off, it's now. And the reasoning is, as you just alluded to, the extremely weak position that Volodymyr Zelensky is in right now. I mean, it's the conditions on the ground that are suddenly helping Trump. Zelensky's very tainted by the corruption scandal, tainted by other potential corruption scandals that are now coming up, tainted by the fact that his own polls show his people are not very happy with him, and tainted maybe most of all by the conditions on the front lines of the war. He's getting his ass kicked. That gives Trump Trump likes a situation like that. For Trump, the world is very simple. This guy's strong, this guy's weak. This guy's a winner, this guy's a loser. That's the way he sees the world. So in his mind right now, Russia's winning, Ukraine's losing, I'm going to go with the winner. It's that simple.
I mean, I think definitely Russia has made important gains in the last many weeks since Trump imposed his secondary tariffs and said, you know, he was annoyed with Putin and so on. So, you know, to that extent, I think you're right. I also agree with you, of course, that if he's going to come up with some sort of agreement, then right now he's in a stronger position than before. But let me say one thing, which is that I think that in that case, Zelensky being in a weak position but remaining president is probably more useful to him, because you don't know who will replace Zelensky.
Yeah.
Will it be some even more hardline figure
smart.
Who is, you know, not going to negotiate, etc.? So we'll have to wait and see. But, I agree that, but what I'm saying is that it is not, you know, the Russian position has not changed in a long time. So what I'm saying is that Trump has gone in and out. So yes, you know, he has today been annoyed with Zelensky. Tomorrow he has been annoyed with Putin and so on. So he has kind of done this yo-yo on this matter as well. And now his officials are talking so far, at least as far as I know, the White House had not said that they are backing this or anything. They're saying, let's see what's happening. I think Vance said something about, they're being, you know, they're waiting and watching or something. So we'll just have to see how it operates. But if the Russians stick to their position that, you know, our position will not substantially change, then it will be a peace deal in which Trump will have finally come to the realization that the Russian position is the one to go with, et cetera. But so far, he has not done that.
Well, speaking of Vance, I'm glad you mentioned him, because I'm thinking about Canada, I'm thinking about the Europeans, I'm thinking about all those other countries that surround the United States or look to the United States for leadership. And they're in a weaker position than I've ever seen them in my lifetime. I'm seeing things out of Germany, out of the EU in particular, out of France. Their leaders are barely respected. Their people are on the streets. Their inflation levels are through the roof. Their wages are down. I mean, you know, I could go on and on. It's a really tough time. I've heard Mearsheimer. I've heard McGregor. I've heard other people that I follow, you know, sometimes they're right, sometimes like they're wrong, like all of us, but saying, you know, the demise of these elitists in Europe and these other countries is almost a destiny. Like, it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time.
Yes.
Do you agree?
Yes, I entirely. I mean, I think, you know, take Mark Carney. I mean, just a few months ago, he won a very thumping election victory. And already people are being very critical of Carney in Canada for essentially not being able to deliver anything, you know, on, you know, he said he was going to stand up to Trump. There is very little evidence that he's doing anything of the sort. In fact, he even tried to, essentially tried to make nice with Trump in the aftermath of this Ontario premier posting this ad about tariffs and so on. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is that he's definitely not able to do this. I think the European, absolutely, they are extremely unpopular governments, and we will again have to see, what's coming up. But at the moment, their position, I mean, in a certain sense, actually, their addiction to the war. I mean, my position is, you know, why is Europe addicted to this war in Ukraine? I think they're addicted to the war in Ukraine because that's the only way in which they can shore up what little support they have and try and use the war as an excuse to shut down and discredit the opposition and so on. But absolutely, they're in very deep trouble.
You know, I'm just wondering your thoughts, since it's our part of the world, yours and mine, North America. What do you think of all this tomfoolery taking place with the threats against Venezuela and Colombia and blowing up boats at sea? You've seen some of this stuff manifest itself. The pictures are pretty weird. And you and I both know that if you're going to look for problematic drug cartels and serious drug traffic in this world, there's a hell of a lot better places to start than Venezuela.
Absolutely. First of all, I would say that the whole premise for Trump's actions against Venezuela, the massing of military hardware in the Caribbean basin, all of this is done on the basis of an excuse which is completely flimsy. I mean, even if it were true that Maduro is the head of this cartel that Trump says he's the head of, and that he's running some kind of drugs in Venezuela, I mean, the mainstream press, I mean, one of the great things about living at this time, of course, is that a lot of the truth is being told. You know, when thieves fall out, they tell the truth about one another. So the Democratic, you know, establishment press is telling the truth about Trump, and Trump folks are telling the truth about the Democrats. So this is really interesting. But anyway, so the mainstream establishment press has actually said that there is, you know, it is, in terms of international law, it is completely illegal. Trump has already essentially killed, assassinated dozens of people in the name of this. And that's why the British, fearing that they may be held to account for their complicity with these killings, they have said, we are no longer going to exchange intelligence with the United States on this matter and so on. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I'm not sure, you know, everything, you know, a lot of people fear that Trump will invade Venezuela. I don't think it's going to be that easy to invade Venezuela.
No.
Because although the Western press keeps saying that, you know, Maduro is, losing support and, you know, the army is not able to recruit people and so on, the Venezuelan army is deeply behind the Bolivarian revolution. I mean, it's a Bolivarian process, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the United States has never been particularly good at boots on the ground anyway. So I think that the worst that will happen, and I'm not saying this is a small thing, but Trump will bomb Venezuela, perhaps. He certainly likes bombing places. But beyond that, I'm not sure that he can effect regime change and so on. So I think that, I think this is a lot of... and I think also with these actions, he's discrediting himself in the eyes of the Americas as well. You know, one of Trump's priorities is to reduce the extent of Chinese and, for that matter, Russian influence in Latin America. Well, I think that he may very well end up inadvertently increasing it.
You know, it's funny, listening to that, I recall conversations I've had with people who I know inside the Trump administration early on when he was first being elected or had been elected. And they told me that Latin America is going to be important. That's a new initiative. They need to go in there and somehow try and fight back against what the Chinese have done in Latin America, what the Russians have done in Latin America, what the Iranians have done in Latin America. They've gained influence and respect in that region, and somehow the United States is going to have to figure out a way to combat that. I got to tell you, just listening to you the way you just described that right now, if this is their way of combating that, it is the wrong way to do it. Because this reminds everybody I know, I'm from Latin America, it reminds all of us from that part of the world of exactly what the United States and the CIA did for the last 100 years. And it was the wrong way. And it's the reason that a lot of people in Latin America and other parts of the world are kind of embracing the Chinese and other countries as they come in. And they say, well, at least you're not going to do it through force, right? And I think that's the mindset that is being missed in the White House, my humble opinion.
You know, and there is another thing, you know, one of the things that I've always emphasized is that, you know, Trump's aggression, apart from this deployment in the Caribbean, it has mostly been economic. But yeah, it is, this economic aggression is also not working. I mean, basically, Trump has had, the importance of the United, I mean, the tariffs would only work if the United States was a really big importer of goods from all over the world. But the position of the United States in world trade has declined. I mean, once upon a time, it was importing a quarter of all the world's goods. Today, it is about half of that. The most recent figure I have read is 13% of imports. And of course, the tariffs are only going to reduce that share even more. Because what does it mean when you impose tariffs? It says to the rest of the world, we don't want to import any more from you. Well, in that case, the world is going to say, fine, even Canada. You know, I used to say that, you know, given the relatively low share of the U.S., U.S. is still the largest importer, but, you know, it's not huge. But given the share of the U.S. In world imports, only Canada and Mexico are really, the United States has sort of got them by the throat. Everybody else can survive the shock, the trade shock that the tariffs will give. I would say that, but now I see that even Canada is now increasingly diversifying its trade, because no matter how much Carney would love to suck up to the Trump administration, and I do believe he'd like to do that, no matter how much the Canadian ruling class would like to do that, because they cast their lot with the United States back in 1988, even though lots of people were saying we are already too dependent on the United States, we ought to diversify our trade. So, you know, for nearly 40, 35 years later, they are now learning the bitter lessons of having done that. But at least now that lesson is sinking in. And, you know, at the end of the day, what are Canadians going to do? What are Canadian businesses going to do except find markets elsewhere?
Makes sense. Radhika Desai, you are wonderful. Thank you so much. I always appreciate a conversation with you. And by the way, we got millions of people watching us right now. If there's anything that you'd like to share with them, or if you want to tell them how they can get hold of you or where they can read what you write or whatever it is you want to do, please, this is your moment.
Sure. They can go to my website, radhikadesai.com.
That's great. Thank you, my dear. Always good to see you.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much. Well, I'll tell you what, so many of you have listened to conversations like the one I just had with Radhika, the professor, or with John Kovalik yesterday, and you're sharing your opinions, and I'm glad you are. So let's start with the imperialist. He's wondering, why should Russia agree to a deal with the United States when the U.S. has proven to be unreliable liars on these matters? That's not a bad question. Not a bad question at all. Patino SNDR says, I say this with regret. As long as the military-industrial complex has its hands on all of this, there will be no peace, referring to our conversation yesterday about the peace plan being discussed by Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Dmitriev. Eve228 says, this expert, this is John, who we spoke with yesterday, this expert thinks Ukraine's EU membership is the key issue and not NATO membership? That's what he said. That's what he said. I disagreed with him too, but that's what he said. Mirosaw says, she's thanking us and saying, very informative as usual. That's nice. Thank you so much. I'll take the compliments too. And the good and the bad, as they say. Listen, I love hearing from most of you. No, I love hearing from all of you. You're the ones who criticize me. Keep it coming. We're all for it. Good, bad, indifferent. We're glad to be able to hear from you. And we read what you write, obviously. You can go to Journalistically Speaking. It's on YouTube. Journalistically Speaking with Rick Sanchez and let us know what you think. Or you can go to X or Twitter. There I am, Rick Sanchez TV. That's my handle, Rick Sanchez TV. Thanks for being with us. We'll be looking for you next time. And thank you for, well, allowing us into your home. Good night.